It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Betty White has become a pop culture icon for young and old. A new Betty White documentary just hit Netflix. We'll talk to the Wisconsin producer. First, new numbers out today tell us more about how many Americans are experiencing loneliness. The 2020 Loneliness Index from the health organization Cigna says 3 in 5 Americans consider themselves lonely. They're also reporting an increase in loneliness of about 13% from year to year. This only goes back to 2018, the first year Cigna conducted this survey. Their latest data are based on answers from a group of more than 10,000 adult workers surveyed in July and August of last year. Kristen Radke has been following the issue of loneliness and collecting stories from people who have felt loneliness now or at some point in their lives. The Wisconsin native has authored the book Imagine Wanting Only This, a graphic memoir about loss, and a forthcoming work, Seek You, Essays on American Loneliness. Kristen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Well, last time you were on, we talked about your project that you're working on for this book, I think due out next year. Can you tell us what you are looking for from people when they talk about loneliness?
Yeah, I mean, so when I started this project, I didn't really realize that loneliness was an interest of mine. I didn't really connect the dots on that, but I recognized that I really loved observing people sort of alone in public places. And I started thinking a lot about solitude and loneliness and what the difference is between those two things. And once I started that project, I was amazed that it seemed like everybody had a story or many stories about feeling really lonely.
Yeah, we have this new study out today. By coincidence, we were going to talk to you anyway, but it seems to make the case that loneliness is pretty common among Americans, maybe on the rise. And as you say, as you talk to people, you're seeing that anecdotally, too.
Absolutely. I mean, and that study shows that loneliness has risen, I think, 18%. I could be wrong. 18% since 2018, which is, you know, that's a wild increase in such a short amount of time.
And when you talk to people, what do they say is driving their loneliness? What are some of the things that make them think they don't have this connection, this contact with people?
Well, what's so interesting is that everyone's story is so different, but there's always like this sort of underlying germ of the same feeling. Like in a certain way, I think loneliness is one of the most universal things that we all experience. Everyone has a different threshold for loneliness. Something that makes someone feel lonely is totally different than what someone else feels lonely. And that's actually biologically programmed into us. Every single person at birth wants a certain amount of human connection and needs a certain amount of human connection. And there's really nothing you can do to change that.
Interesting. So what might feel lonely to me might feel fine to you or vice versa.
Exactly. Exactly. So you might be able to say, I'm going to hole up in my house and work on this and, you know, paint my whole house alone for a week and like read novels and whatever and not talk to anyone. And you might feel great and feel totally satisfied with that time. And I might totally lose my mind.
But then there's that difference. And you said it right off the bat, loneliness versus solitude. And that seems like a decision. Solitude, if I pick a day where I don't want to talk to people, that's my choice. Loneliness is something that happens to me. And that seems like an important difference, right?
Absolutely. So basically, scientists and researchers define loneliness as the gap between the relationships and the connections you have and the relationships and the connections you want. So even if you have a really full house, you have, maybe you have great relationships with your parents and with your brothers and sisters. You have a really active social life. You still might feel desire for something else that you're not getting from those relationships.
Talking to Kristen Radke about loneliness. She's got a book coming out next year, Seek You, Essays on American Loneliness. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a story about an experience going into or out of loneliness at some stage of your life or other. Kristen, when you talk to people, are there people feeling like they're always lonely, they always have been, or is it something that maybe at different stages of their lives they come into and maybe then out of?
Yeah. So loneliness is really common at three specific stages in our lives. One is in our 20s when we're often going through a lot of life changes. We may be leaving home for the first time, things like that. In our 50s, which is late 50s, which is a pretty common retirement age where, you know, kids are leaving the house, things like that. And then in our 80s. And there, obviously, we're facing probably the death of a lot of people close to us or a lack in mobility. So when I was talking to people, I talked to a lot of women who felt really, really lonely during their pregnancies and right after they gave birth. They felt very isolated by that and unable to share those experiences. One of my favorite anecdotes is this this mother who she hadn't heard from her children who were older, who were grown up on Mother's Day. And she got the doorbell rang and it was flowers. And she was so excited because she thought it was flowers from her kids. But then they were for like the woman next door who was always terrible to her. So she's never forgotten that anecdote 20 years later. Like that was the first thing she thought of to share with me.
Huh. Now, are there social things that are built in that like walls we've erected in our society that make us more prone to be lonely?
Well, certainly there's a lot of arguments being made about technology. I go back and forth on this. I think technology has given some people access to whole new communities. You know, whole relationships can be forged often online. People who have low mobility or may have disabilities, you know, something like social networking has totally changed their lives. But then there's also like the American ethos, which, you know, in America, we're like, we have all these like bootstrap pulling, frontier conquering, make it on our own ideologies. You know, that's like at the center of what we've coined American since the days of the frontier.
Does that make us reluctant to seek help for loneliness? If I acknowledge that loneliness is a problem, that means I've failed to do it all for myself?
Absolutely. I think it makes us fail to seek out help for anything. I mean, I think that's why it took people so long, or culturally it took us so long to accept things like depression as like a really serious health problem that we could seek help for without shame. I don't think that has quite happened for loneliness yet. I think we're still embarrassed to admit when we feel loneliness because it seems like you're saying, you know, something's really wrong with me.
I read a thing going on in Japan now, a trend. I don't know if it's going to be short or long term. A lot of loneliness and isolation, but then younger people steering into it. They are going out on a lonely person or solo person dates, and now restaurants are catering to tables for one, things like that. Have you encountered, as you seek out stories, people who said, hey, I'm in this situation, I'm going to embrace it and just make the best of it?
Yeah. You know, there was this viral video on YouTube called How to Be Alone, which came out over 10 years ago now. And, you know, it was just sort of this rallying cry for being single, for being independent. And I think that's really great. I think we should, you know, but going out to dinner alone and doing those things alone is different than chronic loneliness. You know, so we have situational loneliness. Maybe we move somewhere for a new job. Maybe we go through a breakup, something like that. Like those are all really normal to be expected. You know, there are points in your life you're going to feel lonely. The problem is if you go a decade, two decades without feeling meaningful connection, suddenly loneliness becomes really dangerous because we actually lose our ability then to form new relationships. Those skills that we had before become diminished. We're more likely to be suspicious of new people. We're not quite sure how to strike up a new bond. So that's when loneliness becomes a really scary problem.
And another part of the problem, I hear often about the health benefits of social connection, of being connected to people. Does that mean on the flip side, we have health concerns if we aren't getting those connections?
Absolutely. So scientists have talked about that loneliness researchers have, that for a long time, loneliness researchers stood behind what they called the social control hypothesis, because they realized that lonely people were dying at significantly more rapid rates than people who didn't identify as lonely. And they thought, oh, you know, well, if someone doesn't spend a lot of time with someone else, you know, there's no one there to tell them not to smoke or to tell them to eat healthy or things like that. Like they were certain, you know, if no one's around when you fall off a chair, you know, to give you help, things like that. But then over time, they realized that the difference between in life expectancy was too great to account for things like, you know, smoking or sitting still for too long. And it was actually, it actually resulted just in a weakening of our immune system and a much higher susceptibility to things like cancer and heart disease.
Now, when I hear that, it's true and it's something to worry about, but I don't want people who are experiencing loneliness to feel even worse about themselves hearing that. Do you have encouraging examples from people you talked to who maybe were in that span of loneliness and worked their way out of it?
Well, I think the thing that's so encouraging about talking about loneliness is that it makes you feel less lonely because you realize everyone feels this way at a certain point. I mean, I think loneliness is something we should treat loneliness the way we treat hunger, the way we treat thirst. Like the loneliness is calling out a need that we have. And it's saying you need to seek someone out. You need to make a change. And if we listen to it, then loneliness is doing what it was meant to do in human evolution.
We're talking to author Kristen Radke about loneliness in the United States today. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you more lonely now than you used to be? Or did you go through a stage of your life where yeah, you felt more lonely. You didn't have those connections for one reason or another. What was behind that? If you found a way out of it, if you found a way to make those connections, renew them or find new ones, love to hear from you how you did it, what worked for you, maybe what didn't work along the way. And do you see things in just the way our society is set up that you think make us more prone to be and feel lonely? And for you, what's the distinction between being lonely and having solitude that you actually want? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our talk about loneliness in the United States. Author Christine Radke is with us. Her new book, Seek You, Essays on American Loneliness, is due out next year. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced a spike in loneliness at some point in your life? Maybe a transition phase, the 20s, the 50s, the 80s? What questions do you have for our guest about loneliness? Did you find a way out of loneliness at some point in your life? Love to hear your story. At 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kristen, you're still in process on this book and in collecting stories, but do you feel like you're learning lessons, maybe unexpected lessons about loneliness along the way?
You know, it's a really interesting question. I think I did not realize really what a problem it was, what a universal feeling. But I also experienced, a sense of hope in collecting these stories because people were so willing to talk about them. And because, like I mentioned, you know, loneliness should help us seek out one another. And I hope it encourages people to reach out maybe more than we traditionally do.
We've got some callers reaching out now at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us in Mesa, Arizona. Lori, hi.
Hi, Rob. Great topic.
Thanks.
I'm a retired nurse, and I recall many a time patients complaining of loneliness. Mm. And I just could not, I understood that this was some kind of a deep emotional need, but I could not relate to it. I myself don't feel that I've ever experienced loneliness. I was an only child for a long time. Maybe that has something to do with it. But I enjoy my time alone. And I have girlfriends that are always complaining of loneliness. My grandmother, oh my God, she drove me nuts. Complaining of loneliness. She couldn't understand why I wasn't lonely.
Lori, thank you so much for the call. And Kristen, that gets back to something you said. We all might have our own individual loneliness thresholds.
Exactly. Some people, loneliness is not at all about the amount of time you spend alone. There's absolutely no correlation to how much time you spend alone. I have a friend, too, who says she's never been lonely. And there are just so lucky few who are really unaffected by it and who really enjoy solitude, which is wonderful.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We'll go now to Derek with us in Belleville. Derek, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Derek?
Well, my loneliness started about 35 years ago. I was in a band. I was with, I had friends, I had a great family. Loneliness was I didn't even think about ever being lonely. Well, 35 years later, I was convicted with a charge that pretty much changed my life drastically. I lost my family. I lost my child. I lost my friends. I lost my coworkers. Just everything. And 35 years now, I'm still at that point where, I cannot make any new. I can't join clubs. I can't. Because mm-hmm. I'm scared that they're going to find out, hey, this guy has got a felony. Oh, no. We're not going to, interact with him. So here I am with my house, and I'm just usually I do everything. I hike and all that stuff all by myself. And
Derek, I'm sorry to hear that, and good luck to you in dealing with that. Kristen, my first thought is, well, kind of a unique story, but not that unique. There are a lot of people who are, you know, ex-felons who are out of the criminal justice system now who face unique challenges in making those connections.
Absolutely. It's unfortunately a really common American story, particularly for people who've been incarcerated. The transition back into society is often a really brutal time that can go on for, you know, for decades.
Thanks for sharing that story. And it makes me think, like, do we have supports in place, not just for people coming out of ex-felons or, you know, coming out of prison, but, you know, we know when loneliness happens often, as you
right.
were saying, you move to a new place, there's a big life change. Do we have support systems built in this country for those places where we know the loneliness is a coming?
Not nearly as much as we should. There are countries that are much ahead of us here. The UK is one of them. 2 years ago, they appointed a government position called the Minister of Loneliness, which is a, you know, spectacularly weird job title. But there's lots of initiatives going on in several countries about how do we combat this, because it's a health issue. You know, the former U.S. Surgeon General has called it one of the biggest health crises in America. You know, we're reaching an epidemic level. So it's something we need to treat as just as serious as cancer or obesity or heart disease or diabetes or any of the things that we spend a lot of time and money trying to fight.
Derek, thanks again for sharing your story. We'll go to Cole now with us in Stevens Point. Hi, Cole.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just wondering what your guest thoughts were on the connection between grief and loneliness, because I know in my own life, one of the loneliest times I ever had was when I lost my dad. So I was just wondering what the guest thoughts were on that.
Cole.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Go ahead, Kristen.
I'm sorry
yeah.
about your dad. Absolutely. I mean, when you're grieving someone you love, it's you know, it's one of the most stressful, loneliest points in a person's life. And even if someone has a really active support system in those moments, of course, we're, you know, we're really longing for a specific person. So, you know, that's a kind of loneliness that's so targeted and so specific, but it's also something that can go on for so many years. And that's why, fortunately, there are so many grief support networks in America, and that's something I really encourage people to utilize.
Well, yeah, it's a double whammy there because you're sad about the loss, of course, but then also that person filled a social role in your life. They were part of
Absolutely.
Your network that you would turn to when you were feeling lonely.
Absolutely. I think loneliness often spikes too during moments when you're doing something you wish you could share with another person. And so when we lose someone who maybe we used to do a specific activity with, or if you needed advice about something, you could call that person. Suddenly this gap is just, you know, this huge flag every time, every day that you're usually do that thing. So the changes in routine are often a really big catalyst for loneliness.
Thanks a lot for that call, Cole, and sorry for your loss. We are talking to Kristen Radke about loneliness. She's got a book coming out scheduled for next year, Seek You, Essays on American Loneliness. Back to your calls now. Michael joins us in Merrimack. Michael, hello.
Hey, good evening. My question is about trust. When you get out of a relationship and you start a new relationship, you had that period of time when you were lonely. Not you were alone, but you weren't really lonely. But now here it is, you're starting this new relationship, and you have to learn to trust all over again. How does trust fit into that?
Interesting, Michael. Thanks for the call, Kristen.
Michael, that is so true. So trust is the foundation of any bond that we form. So the eradication of trust means, you know, we're really separated from one another. Trust is the most integral part to forming relationships, period, no matter what. So, yeah, that's really, really difficult. Like I mentioned before, the longer we feel isolated, biologically, our you know, our walls are up. We're much more likely to accept a new person into our lives and to trust them because we feel, you know, we have our guards up. We're trying to protect ourselves. So I think part of that is if you can recognize that you're feeling that way and try to push through that, some of those barriers might break down a little bit more quickly. It's about identifying that and acknowledging, okay, I'm feeling this thing. Now I'm going to work to actively push against it.
Michael, thanks a lot for that call. I had wanted to ask you about another group, Kristen. You'd mentioned young women, maybe new moms feeling mm-hmm. lonely. I keep seeing stories about older guys, 50s and up, not having friendships and that being a risk time for loneliness for aging men. Is that something you've encountered?
Absolutely, absolutely. Men are more likely to be lonely than women. The main reason for that is that men statistically, they make a lot of relationships young in their when they're young in their life, and then they're like, these are my friends, these are my people. And they move forward forever without often making a lot of new friendships. So over time, you know, disagreements, people fall away, people move, people die. But women are much more likely to, you know, at every stage in their life, they're constantly sort of expanding that social circle. Women are often in heterosexual relationships, the ones who manage the social calendar, things like that. So women are much more likely to remain connected throughout their life than men are.
Let's go to one more caller, I think, before we're done. Kylie is with us in Sparta. Kylie, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Kylie?
Well, what I wanted to say is I kind of have a different view, and that is that I don't think loneliness itself is the problem. I think it's the stigma attached to loneliness. And an example would be that, like, if I, this past weekend, go to a movie by myself and then, you know, at work, I'm talking about it with my coworkers, and they're like, what? You went to the movies by yourself? Are you crazy?
Kylie, thanks for the call. Kristen, it can be a little of both, right? Loneliness can be a problem in and of itself, but that stigma Kylie sees isn't going to help.
Absolutely. You know, loneliness is something we need to destigmatize. It has nothing to do with, like, how cool and fun and exciting a person is to be around. You know, it doesn't mean that this is, you know, no one wants to come to your birthday party, right? It doesn't mean you're unpopular, uncool, or a loser, you know. But, like, I've in certain moments of my life when I felt lonely, I'm afraid to admit that because you want to feel like the kind of person who's surrounded by really exciting people all the time and who's really connected to others. But yeah, I mean, I love going to the movies by myself or dinner by myself. I think it's something we should all do.
Kylie, thanks for that call. And Kristen, we'll watch for your book out next year. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
That's Green Bay native Kristen Radke. Her project, Seek You, Essays on American Loneliness, is due out in 2021. We talked to her today about trends in loneliness in America today. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, Betty White has been on America's televisions over the course of 9 decades. We'll talk to the Wisconsin producer of a documentary about her life that just hit Netflix. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers delivered his second State of the State address at the Capitol last night. We'll talk about the highlights and what the speech said about Wisconsin politics. First, maybe you got hooked on the Golden Girls or the Mary Tyler Moore Show or even the Betty White Show. Betty White's been on TV for 70 years, long enough to have fans of all different generations. Betty White turned 98 last week, and just in time to celebrate, you can watch a documentary about her life on TV produced by a Wisconsin filmmaker. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of Betty White? Did you sign a social media petition to get her onto Saturday Night Live? Why are you a fan? What memories of watching her do you have? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Steve Boettcher is co-founder of Boettcher and Trinkline Television based in Milwaukee. He produced the documentary Betty White, the First Lady of Television, that's now available for streaming on Netflix. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob, thank you very much.
Well, I was going to ask why you wanted to make a documentary about Betty White, but then I thought, why wouldn't you want to make a documentary about
exactly
Betty White?
Right. I mean, TV was invented for Betty, and she's taken full advantage of it, really. So 1939 was her first experimental television experience with television. She was in high school, and they were kind of working out the cameras. So it's been 80 years, really, you think about it, with that first shot at being in front of cameras.
And in your documentary, she talks about this show. She'd been on radio, actually, which I respect. And then she and her co-host did this show that was just them on TV for hours, in some cases just unscripted, just doing stuff.
Yeah, they just literally set up a camera pretty much and did radio, and for 5 or 6 hours every single day. So that was kind of the birth of television, I think, and Betty.
And yeah, they were kind of making it up as they went, and she was groundbreaking in a lot of ways. She was first, she had her own variety show. She ended up being a producer, I think one of the first women in TV producers. She did a lot of stuff that people who watched her, like me, from Mary Tyler Moore or Golden Girls on, might not have known.
Yeah, it's so true. She hired the first woman director for television and was nominated for the first Emmy. So yeah, she's been there, and she was truly the first. And I think, you know, really, as you watch the documentary, you can't help but know that, you know, at 98 years old, she's like an eternal optimist. She's got great tenacity. She's very genuine. And she is exactly the way you want her to be. We spent about 10 years working on this project, and she is just the way you want Betty to be.
And she talks about even into her 90s, still a little bit of that, not full on stage fright, I don't think, but a little of the butterflies that any performer might get.
Yeah, I think that's what makes her also so, like, real and just very spontaneous, and she's very quick-witted, and that has served her well. Even from, you know, from the radio days, just her being quick on her feet is always something that you see with Betty.
You talk to a lot of, well, celebrities who have worked with her, but also some people close to her. She's been in kind of a pop culture icon lately, and I want to give a listen to what some of the people you talked to had to say about sort of a second or third or maybe fifth part of her career. Here it is.
Her demographic sort of exploded, you know, all of a sudden there were kids who were 5 and people who were 95. They just loved her across the board, and she became cool.
All at once, this character actress became a star. And what I find fascinating is that she's the only one who doesn't know it, because I don't think she ever framed her life that way.
So that's her executive assistant and a friend of hers talking. And can you talk about that weird sort of rebirth of Betty White in the public eye?
Yeah, it's so true. Like, you know, we know about it. Kids know about it. Every age group knows Betty White. And whether it's the Snickers commercials or all the television series or hosting SNL, we all know Betty. And that's pretty unique for an entertainer. She's stayed relevant every single day of her career.
And yeah, that Saturday Night Live thing, there was this big petition to get her to host, a huge response on social media. She ends up doing it, and you talked to some of the SNL women in particular who got to work with her, and what a treat it was for them to work with this legend.
Yeah, it was like, we talked to Tina Fey about it, and she just said, you know, we just, you know, and so much energy. That show is just exhausting to do, and it's an exhausting week. And then, you know, it's late on Saturday. It's really a hard show to do, and she just killed it. It was a Mother's Day special. It is still one of the highest-rated SNL episodes in the history of SNL.
Oh, and it's kind of this funny irony, like, oh, everybody's kind of worried, how's she going to do on live TV, when she, you know, kind of helped sort of invent live TV in a lot of ways.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Tina Fey says, she asked her one day, like, what's the success, Betty? And Betty said, it's vodka and hot dogs. That's exactly the success.
Talking to Steve Boettcher, co-founder of Boettcher and Trinkline Television, based in Milwaukee. He produced the documentary we're talking about, Betty White, the First Lady of Television. Now, she had Betty White had a big connection with game shows as a special celebrity guest, and also won an Emmy for hosting a game show. And she met her husband, Alan Ludden, while playing on a game show. Let's take a listen here.
I flew to New York to do a couple of things, and Password was one of them, and I fell in love with the game. I love the game of Password.
This is the sparkling television star and great Password player, Betty White.
The host was very nice and very attractive, and I thought, oh.
Hello, Alan.
What are your plans for the summer, Betty?
Well, I'm going to do some... What did you have in mind, Alan?
A great story. And she really, I think sometimes in the 70s in particular, it was kind of a celebrity duty to be on game shows. It seemed like she really liked it.
Well, and that was Alan Ludden, the host of Password,
right,
who's from Mineral Point.
Oh, I didn't know
right
that.
Down the road from Madison. And that's her great connection to Wisconsin and our area. And she's from Illinois originally. So, yeah, she just loved the games. That's kind of her competitive spirit. She loves games even today. We have a scene in the film where she's playing Scrabble with some of her very, very dear friends, and she still loves games and loves words and loves playing word games.
Yeah, let's give it. We actually have a little clip of part of that that Scrabble scene from the documentary.
But then suddenly I feel her getting edgy. She wants to get to the table. She is ruthless. Let me tell you, ruthless. She always says, well, I know we're friends here, but when we get over there, all friendships cease. And she means it. And I have to tell you, she beats us most of the time.
So Betty White's a cutthroat Scrabble player.
Yeah. Yeah, she's awesome. She really is. And you know, and some of our best friends are of the younger generation, if you will. Ryan Reynolds is in the film, and Ryan believes he owes her career to Betty White and literally like holds her up on that kind of a pedestal. It was because of the proposal and the success of that movie that launched his career, he feels. And Betty was key to that.
She also loves, Betty White loves animals. You've got some footage of Betty feeding a bear in the documentary, just Betty and the bear side by side. And let's listen to what Betty says about her support for animals.
Well, that's my life. The reason I work, the reason I do anything is because of my love of animals.
She's enjoying his love right now.
Yes. She says all the time, I have to keep doing my acting job so I can support my animal causes.
So an iconic actress on TV for decades. She's got this passion for animals. Is that something she talked a lot about as you worked with her?
Yeah, she did. I actually filmed the documentary as well, and we're inside of this beautiful compound where they keep this 900-pound grizzly, and Betty sits right next to him. And at some point, I'm kind of taking my eye out of the viewfinder, and I realize I am like 3 feet from this 900-pound grizzly, and she's feeding it marshmallows. But and I think, you know, that's Betty's legacy. Quite honestly, she hopes she's remembered for being so active in helping animal causes and financially being there and supporting animals. And that's really something that's really near and dear to her heart.
You talked to a lot of people in this documentary who had worked with her in the last few years and going all the way back to her Betty White show, one of the dancers, one of the announcers from one of her early shows. Did you get a sense from them of just what it was like, what it's been like to work with Betty White?
You know, she is beloved. She's very, very smart and very caring about everybody. And there's a line early in the film about she believes when people are on the big screen, they're unapproachable. But when they're on a television screen at people's homes, you always have to be approachable because you go into their homes and you go where they live. And she always believes that you have to be very approachable. So whether it was going through airports with her or being out at events with her, she will sign every autograph. She's just so incredible, genuine, and just loves people. And it's so clear. And she's beloved. People love working with her. And I think what was key, we noticed too with crew, she always knew like the lighting person's name of their pet and how their pet is doing and the kids of the audio or the wardrobe people or whoever. And she cared enough to really want to be part of their life.
And something that comes through from your documentary is that she seems to really have had and maintained a love for the work of being on TV.
Yeah, you know, I asked her, like, of things in the past that, you know, she loved doing or being a part of. She does not dwell in past. She always talked about what she's doing next week or in 2 weeks or in a month from now. She spent more time looking through the front window than the rearview window or the rearview mirrors and just was very focused on what's next in her career and looking forward. And it's kind of a great lesson in life, I think.
Steve, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, look, I'm glad you guys have a chance to watch her. She's great. She really is.
That's Steve Betcher, co-founder of Betcher and Trinkline Television based in Milwaukee. He produced the documentary we've been talking about. It's called Betty White, the First Lady of Television. That's now available for streaming on Netflix. Coming up, we'll talk about last night's State of the State speech and what it can mean for legislation and Wisconsin politics this year. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a historian joins the show to talk about what explains President Trump's rise in politics and to make the case that Trump is the political outsider the country needed. First, Governor Tony Evers delivered his second State of the State address last night in the State Assembly Chamber.
As I reflect on my first year in office, although there were setbacks and occasional political posturing, what I call huffing and puffing, we also had a lot of success, and I'm proud of everything we accomplished in just a year's time.
Governor Evers pointed towards statewide successes such as expanding health care access in rural areas and increased state spending on education. Evers also announced new groups being tasked with investigating the impact student loan debt has on Wisconsinites and nonpartisan redistricting. He also announced a special legislative session on the rural economy. Our next guest joins us to talk about last night's address. Arnold Schober is professor of government at Lawrence University in Appleton. Arnold, welcome back to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, some political posturing and huffing and puffing. Do you see a little more to it than that in the standoff between the governor, Democratic governor and Republican lawmakers?
I don't see it ending. In fact, there was a lot of kind of inside baseball in that speech where Evers was really trying to kind of get back at the Republicans in the legislature from the last year's work. You saw a lot of talk about kind of agriculture. Evers was famously extremely, quote, PO'd about them turning down his nominee for debt cap, and that came through in the address. And he also mentioned many things that they had stripped out of the budget. So I think he's not quite settled on a new agenda this year, but will try to do many of the same things by other means.
The governor did try to highlight some cases of bipartisan cooperation on particular bills, giving nods to Democrats and Republicans who work together and saying, hey, we can find common ground on issues like supporting agriculture in Wisconsin. Do you think past all the debate, there's room to get that kind of thing done?
I think there's room. I mean, farm issues are an area that Republicans, most of the Republicans represent most of the agricultural parts of the state. And so for them, it's much more of a constituency issue, perhaps, than some of the Democrats in the legislature. And so he's trying to play to them and their issues and really inviting them to come along. Now, they have, as you know and your listeners know, have big differences with the governor about how to go about things, the appropriate scope of regulation and whatnot. But he is trying to meet them in a policy area that he knows is important to them and their constituents.
Governor's talking about with this special session that he's calling for things like trying to boost dairy exports from Wisconsin, bring back more extension agents to help farmers out, and boost rural mental health care. Do you see those as being controversial, or are those things that, as you say, Republicans with that rural constituency might be able to get on board with?
They'll certainly be able to get on board with some form of most of them. Now, the mental health issue, the legislature had withheld funding from that last summer, which is one of the reasons Evers was ticked off at them, and Pfaff was as well. But they are issues that are hard to cast in kind of hard partisan light, and I think that there will be some traction. Now, if the form is what the governor wants, it remains to be seen, but I do think we'll see some legislative activity on them.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss sent a press release today stating, quote, "The Assembly will not be on the floor next week. The bills will be referred to committee and hearings will be held. We're currently reviewing the legislation and gathering input from farmers, including farmers from our own caucus," end quote. Voss also talked about the Dairy Innovation Hub and other rural initiatives. What's your takeaway? Lukewarm reception in that statement?
That's pretty lukewarm. It is true that the Republicans have a number of legislators that list farming as their primary occupation. In fact, by my count in the Blue Book, it's only Republicans that say that. They have some claim to kind of expertise, I guess, but Robin Voss was clearly not going wholehearted for the governor's special session there or even the topics, although, again, they're not things that the Republicans can just brush off and ignore.
Talking to Arnold Schober, political scientist at Lawrence University, looking at Governor Evers' State of the State address. Governor Evers says he's also starting a task force to investigate student debt and its impact on Wisconsinites. Here's some of what he had to say.
We have to work on making higher education available to more folks in our state. We have to understand how education-related debt affects not just our students, but their families, too. And we have to address the fact that student debt is preventing folks from buying a car, starting a business, saving for retirement, and starting for a family.
So starting a task force that doesn't automatically lead to any kind of government action, why do you see this being a priority for the governor and others?
Well, education debt is an issue, especially among kind of more suburban, kind of middle income Wisconsinites as around the country. And this is an area that Democrats typically have a much better kind of polling on than Republicans do. And if you recall the previous couple U.S. Senate elections here, have played on federal themes around student debt. And so Evers, I think, is trying to tap into that kind of uncertainty in that kind of area of political support for himself and in his political party. That would be much harder for Republicans to get on board with, except perhaps with tuition freezes at the UW system or something along those lines.
One of the biggest points of controversy probably coming out of this and debates with Republicans will have to do with redistricting. Nonpartisan redistricting has been gaining momentum in Wisconsin and around the country. Governor Evers talked about that last night.
Unfortunately, nonpartisan redistricting legislation has been introduced for years. It's even received bipartisan support. The bill has never been given a public hearing. Well, when more than 80% of our state supports medical marijuana and 80% support universal background checks and extreme risk protection orders, and 70% support expanding Medicaid, and elected officials can ignore those numbers without consequence, folks, something's wrong.
First of all, Arnold, what do you make of that argument? The governor making the case that our current system of drawing districts makes government, in effect, less accountable to voters.
This is a national conversation, as you know, and that many states are having this question about how much should state legislatures in their partisan makeup of those state legislatures affect the lines that they draw. Wisconsin's constitution does give that to the legislature, not to the governor, so it's unclear that his executive order would carry any legal weight with the legislature or even constitutionally here. Although there is very clear kind of unhappiness with the way lines are drawn in many states, could the Republicans in this state accept a different way to draw the lines? They have in other states. It really comes down to the details of who those quote-unquote non-political people are, whether we might see any support. That said, this current legislature is unlikely to go along with much on that front.
And this is a super timely issue. They just started counting the census, I think, in Alaska a couple days ago. Mm-hmm. And this is an election year, whoever's in control of the legislature this year is going to be in charge of drawing these lines, right? So there's a lot at stake here in 2020.
Yes, this is a pivotal year for the next decade for representation in every state and certainly in our own, both at the federal level for Congress, but those lines for state assembly and state senate will also be redrawn. And that is in Wisconsin, where you see a lot more of those kind of allegations of gerrymandering pop up. The federal lines are perhaps slightly favorable to Republicans here, but the state Senate and district lines, you can see that much more pronounced. And so this is a big political issue. It's a big partisan issue, and neither party really wants to lose control of that.
That said, a fair amount of people are upset about this. Is this something that people tend to vote on? At the voting booth, this might feel like an abstract concept.
I think that you're correct in saying that for many voters, it's very abstract because Americans in general don't understand how the lines come about. Legislators often don't understand all of the mathematical processes that have to go together to get the same number of people in every district. And so it's hard to motivate lots of folks to go to the polls, except, right, in those places where individuals feel somehow disenfranchised by the lines, that they don't have a bigger say, perhaps, in government. So those pockets, there are pockets of voters who will, but in the main, I don't see this as a kind of a banner issue driving thousands of voters to the polls. Some for sure, and will hear it, but as the primary issue, I would be very surprised.
Now, the biggest job usually in state government is coming up with the state budget. That's every 2 years. This is not one of those years. So that said, what are the big issues you're watching in the year to come in our last minute here?
Well, I do think it will be interesting to see if there's traction on that redistricting commission. It is an issue that Democrats can beat over the heads of Republicans ad nauseum. I'm interested where that goes. I am also interested to see where some of the kind of health things happen, kind of vaping reform, kind of vaping issues and mental health issues. Those are ones that are less partisan than the redistricting. It'll be interesting to see how the emphasis lies with, again, the few days left in the state legislative session.
Arnold, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, my pleasure.
We've been talking to Arnold Schober, professor of government at Lawrence University in Appleton. He joins us today to talk about last night's State of the State address delivered by Governor Evers. You can find more about that address, follow our reporting over at WPR.org/news and weigh in with your thoughts, your priorities for what you want to see come out of the governor, the legislature on issues like supporting farmers in the state, how we draw our redistricting lines, and more. That's at WPR.org, or you can always weigh in over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've talked about snacks and beverages in the impeachment hearings over the last couple of days, including the U.S. Senate candy desk, which exists. But those aren't the only food and snack stories in the news this week. Here's one. A college library in England at the University of Liverpool found an unusual bookmark on a book on one of their shelves. A reader was hungry for knowledge, but not for processed cheese. They left a plastic-wrapped cheese slice, like a Kraft single, though I don't know what the brand actually was. They left it pressed in the pages of a book. The library tweeted out a public service announcement, a picture of the offending cheese still in its plastic, and the words, "This is not a bookmark," a message we can all live by. Also in snack news, and this is even weirder, in a preview of their Super Bowl commercial, Planters Peanuts revealed the death of their mascot, Mr. Peanut. We'll find out how he dies, I guess, in a Super Bowl commercial. I'm not an expert on branding, but okay, it seems kind of weird. I do have a Mr. Peanut story, though. A friend of mine from way back, somebody told him about the concept of a spirit animal. And he was kind of skeptical, but open-minded, and said, okay, if I want to find out my spirit animal, how do I do it? Then they told him how to meditate before he went to bed, and he would dream of an animal, and that would be his spirit animal. And that night, he dreamed of Mr. Peanut with his monocle driving an open limousine waving at crowds. So I don't know, you could do worse for a spirit animal. So RIP, I guess, Mr. Peanut. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.